Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the collapse of the ruling coalition in Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu's call for a new election, and speak with Lisa Goldman, the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation, who is a co-founder and contributing editor to 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. We will discuss the makeup of a fourth Netanyahu government that is likely to be more right-wing than the current one, given the firing of the centrist Justice Minister Tzipi Livni and the Finance Minister Yair Lapid on Tuesday night, that signaled the end of Netanyahu's third governing coalition. Then we'll examine how much the drop in oil prices is impacting Russia and President Putin's rule as the ruble drops precipitously and Russian government officials revise their GDP forecast downward for 2015 from a growth of 1.2% to a recession of 0.8%. Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and a professor of security studies at Georgetown and senior fellow in future global resource threats at the Federation of American Scientists, joins us to discuss how much Western sanctions play into Putin's narrative that the West is out to destroy Russia and serve to distract the Russian people from the wholesale theft of the country by Putin and his cronies. Then finally, we'll look into yet another failure to indict a white police officer in the killing of a black man and speak with Brian Levin, a former NYPD police officer who is now a criminologist, civil rights attorney, and professor of justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. We will discuss the anger and dismay that many feel because no charges were brought against the police officer in spite of the use of a chokehold banned by the NYPD since 1985 and the ruling by the medical examiner that the victim's death was a homicide. And joining us now is Lisa Goldman, who is the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation. She has lived and worked for over a decade in the Middle East, covering Israel-Palestine and the immediate region, including the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict and the 2011 Egyptian uprising. She is a co-founder and contributing editor to 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine that is based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Goldman.
Thank you.
And Israel's prime minister has fired his justice minister and his finance minister, both of whom are centrists, and has called for new elections. I believe the new elections are going to be held on March the 17th, 2015. So given this is his fourth government now we're talking about, it's, I guess, getting rid of the centrists would indicate that the next government is likely to be more right-wing than the current one.
Well, probably. Not necessarily. I mean, the thing with Israeli elections is, like, right now it's the polls are sort of showing that there would be a shift to the right and that the next government would be even more right-wing. But that's things in Israel, things have a tendency to change very, very rapidly. So it's really difficult, and I would really caution your listeners against looking at the polls now and predicting the outcome in 2 to 3 months. Things in Israel have been known to change very, very rapidly. You know, it's a very strange situation. On the one hand, the Israel-Palestine conflict is kind of like on a loop, but Israeli domestic politics have the tendency to just shift very radically and very suddenly, and there are all sorts of sort of joker cards that are lurking in the deck right now that could come out. You know, there could be, you know, if the situation in Jerusalem were to heat up even more than it is right now, then that, you know, could affect the vote for the right wing. But it could also affect the vote for the left wing. We really don't know. There are all sorts of swing factors that are quite unpredictable.
So when Henry Kissinger once remarked that Israel doesn't have a foreign policy, it only has domestic politics, with these coalition governments that are usually fairly fragile, when you talk about the possibility of wild cards, particularly in foreign policy, that it's largely the Palestinians you're referring to, right? The possibility of a new intifada?
No, actually, relations with the Palestinians and foreign policy in general are not really driving factors in Israeli voting patterns these years. And I know that must surprise your listeners again, but for the average Israeli voter, the key issues right now are public spending and also wages have been really, the value of wages has declined, and wages themselves have declined, and the cost of living is absolutely sky high in Israel. So, you know, prices for basic consumer goods are higher than they are in New York. And I remember once, for example, someone published a list of the cost of the Billy IKEA bookshelf in 15 different countries, including Saudi Arabia, and it was higher price. It was the highest price in the world was at the IKEA in Israel. So everything from food and housing is astronomically expensive. Consumer goods like furniture and cars are twice as much as they cost in Europe and in the States. But wages are quite low. They're significantly lower than they are in the States, sometimes a third of what you would earn for the same kind of work. So people feel very, very stressed out by the cost of living. There is a sense of upset at the damage that Netanyahu is perceived to have done to relations with the Obama White House. But I think that's not the major factor that's driving the average Israeli voter right now. Don't forget, with Israel's security barriers, the physical barriers that have been erected between Gaza and Israel, between the West Bank and Israel, or parts of the West Bank and Israel. In fact, of course, the security barrier digs well into the West Bank. But the point is that for most Israelis, like most Israelis, have never met a Palestinian. They don't see them. They don't hear about them. The news does. They're not. The issue of Palestine doesn't lead the news at all, in the domestic news at all in Israel. Not at all. Only if there's an act of violence committed against Israeli Jews. So most Israelis are focused on domestic issues that are basically the cost of living and the quality of life, education, health, taxes, all the things that drive American voters.
So if it's all about pocketbook issues, the upcoming election, is that another way let me try and frame it this way. My understanding is that Israel, not only in terms of its politics, but in terms of its economics, has moved to the right and has become a very unequal society, just like the United States is, and that you have oligarchs there and billionaires, and then you have a hollowed-out middle class and a growing impoverished working class. And the idea of this socialist countries formed around kibbutzes is an ancient dream. Is that what the situation is today?
Oh, well, yes, absolutely. First of all, the kibbutz movement was always something more aspirational than real. I mean, only 2% only 2% of the population of Israel lived on kibbutzim, on collective farms. Israel was always more of an urban society, despite its aspirations to create the new Jew and the agrarian society and so forth. But yes, it did have very narrow wealth gaps, and its governments for the first 25 years or more, actually, 30 years of its existence. Yes, the first 30 years of Israel's existence, every single government was socialist oriented. So, and people really cared about that. The wage gaps were very, very low. I think I remember once reading that there was a massive scandal upon discovering that a certain government minister in the 1950s had an apartment with two bedrooms. What did he need two bedrooms for? These days, Israel is a member of the OECD, and it actually has the widest wage gap of any member country of the OECD. The average CEO in Israel earns about 80 times the wage of the secretary. So it's huge. And the cost of housing is so high right now that it's completely impossible for a professional couple, a dual income professional couple with two children, to purchase an apartment pretty much anywhere in the state of Israel that's close to an economic hub, like a suburb of Tel Aviv or a suburb of Jerusalem. So what you have is a situation whereby, you know, you have most of the settlers in the West Bank are not ideological settlers. These are people who, you know, probably grew up in the greater Jerusalem area. They want to live near their parents and their families. And there's just no way they can possibly afford an apartment there in the city because of the real estate costs are very, very high. And in Israel, you can't give a small down payment. You have to give, I think, 60% as a down payment for an apartment. So it's impossible. So people tend to go to the West Bank because housing costs are lower. Mortgages tend to, the conditions for mortgages are more favorable. You get all sorts of subsidized services from public transportation to childcare, early childcare. So it's just economically more feasible, and it's economically possible for young couples with children to purchase an apartment in the West Bank, in the settlements that are in the block close to Jerusalem, than in an urban center like Jerusalem itself or in Tel Aviv. So again, you see, you know, personal concerns, which always tend to drive politics. I mean, that's the norm in any country. Personal financial pocketbook concerns, as you put them, are really the driving factors in every aspect of Israeli political life. They're also driving the settlement movement.
So, Lisa Goldman, back to the new elections and the end of Netanyahu's third coalition government, which did have these big blocks from Tzipi Livni's party, and she's a mm-hmm. former senior Mossad officer, and Yair Lapid, who was a former television personality. They were never a comfortable fit, and it does seem that Netanyahu's is at least... He's warring with a lot of people, but he seems to war more with the centrists than he does with the people to his right. And also, in calling for these new elections, Netanyahu has accused Tzipi Livni and Lapid of plotting a putsch against him. What's the substance of that, or is that just political gossip?
Well, you know, there have been internal arguments over a couple of issues. First of all, Lapid and Livni are they're secular centrists, and they're both theoretically, although, you know, when pushed over the details, probably not so much, but theoretically, they're very strong two-staters. They really want a two-state solution. And Netanyahu has said on several different occasions over the past year that he doesn't want a two-state solution. He hasn't said so explicitly, but he said so implicitly. For example, he said that he could never foresee a time, he would never allow a situation whereby Israel carried out a full military withdrawal from the West Bank because that would endanger the security of Israel's Jewish citizens. So he's made it that means basically that he said he doesn't foresee there ever being an end to the occupation, which is something that we understood from his actions, but to hear him say it is quite another matter. Now, his largest coalition partners are the Israel is Our Home party, which is headed by Avigdor Lieberman, and of course Naftali Bennett's Jewish Home party. Now, Naftali Bennett has, in fact, he wrote in a recent New York Times editorial that he would never stand by and watch Israel broker a two-state solution whereby there would be an independent Palestinian state side by side with the state of Israel. And he said that he thought this would be impossible for Israel's security. Now, Naftali Bennett is a bit of an Israeli everyman. He looks secular, but he wears a small crocheted yarmulke, which indicates that he's modern Orthodox. He fought in an elite combat unit in the army and rose to a pretty significant rank. He is a security guy. He made his money in high tech. He lives in the center of the country, or, you know, he's not, he speaks fluent American English. His parents were born in the States. So he sort of represents the way a lot of Israelis see themselves, sort of Western-oriented, high-tech-oriented, security, hawkish-oriented, and they really don't like Palestinians, okay, or they're afraid of Palestinians. So Bennett could accrue more votes. He's, you know, he's also pushing Netanyahu with, you know, as a person, Bennett, as a person who does represent a sort of Israeli everyman, he's sort of pushing Netanyahu to take a more hawkish line, you know, even more hawkish than he already is. So if Netanyahu wants to create a coalition and keep Bennett's party, which looks poised to gain more seats in the next elections, as well as Lieberman. Now, Lieberman officially is a two-stater, right? But he is a two-stater who wants very significant land swaps, and it's complicated, but never mind. They're both very right-wing hawks, these guys. But they have huge followings, and they have a lot of seats in the Knesset. They're important for the coalition. They are, in a way, more stable partners because they appeal to the Likud base. Netanyahu, of course, is the leader of the Likud party. But Livni and Lapid, you know, they have objected to some of the bills that Netanyahu has been pushing very hard. One of them, of course, is the bill that whereby Israel would define itself as a Jewish state, that where they downgrade Arabic from being an official language to a favored language and so forth. And basically, officially making Arabs, who form 20% of the population of Israel, I'm talking about citizens of Israel, Palestinian citizens of Israel, who have been citizens since 1948, not residents of the occupied territories in the West Bank. These people would become de facto second-class citizens. Don't forget, you know, there are Palestinian citizens of Israel who sit in the Knesset. There's one who sits on the Supreme Court. They're important Israeli academics who are Palestinians, and so forth. So this is a very significant move that would really undermine Israel's democracy, or Israel, you know, Netanyahu was always saying that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and then he would be having, you know, he's pushing this bill that makes Israel into a sort of a very much less democratic state. And this bill, I must say, has also been very disturbing to American Jews who, you know, are also very proud of Israel's democracy. So Livni and Lapid have vociferously objected to this bill, which the right-wing coalition parties want very much to see passed. So, you know, this is something that, you know, I think Netanyahu is looking around and he's thinking that he'll be in a much better position if he calls a de facto referendum. Do you, the people of Israel, want me to continue on this right-wing course whereby I define Israel as a state exclusively for Jews, with everyone else being second-class citizens, where we say explicitly that we're never going to negotiate for a two-state solution, that we're always going to occupy the West Bank militarily, never give the Palestinian residents of the West Bank their rights? Do you want that forever? If yes, vote for me. That's what he's saying. This is what the election is all about.
Well, I read Naftali Bennett's op-ed in the New York Times recently with great interest, and I found it pretty extraordinary and very disingenuous that he was basically saying, under his idea of a one state, the Palestinians could be living in some kind of nirvana as long as they live by Israel's rules. And it made me think, well, why didn't they do that back in 1967 when they took over this territory and allow the Palestinians autonomy, give them education, give them utilities, give them economic opportunity, rather than ghettoize them and use them as cheap labor? They wouldn't have a terrorist problem, I don't think, had they gone that path. So is he really in any way honest about what he's promising the Palestinians?
I mean, honest in what way? What do you mean? What do you think he's promising them?
Well, he's sort of saying that if you basically accept our rules and give up on the two states, you know, you'll be able to live in harmony with us and prosper.
Well, you know, he's saying that you can live in harmony and prosper within tiny little islands, about semi-autonomous islands in the West Bank. He's not saying, you know, you can live autonomously and move freely and have control over your borders and have the rights of citizens. You know, right now, a Palestinian who's arrested by Israeli forces in the West Bank doesn't even have access to a civil trial. You know, so in answer to your question, first of all, Bennett was a child in 1967. I'm not even sure if he was born, actually, and which is when the occupation began. And second of all, you know, at the time, Israel, you know, didn't have any plan to stay in the West Bank indefinitely. It was supposedly billed as a surprise victory, a huge conquest of territory, and there was a lot of internal arguing over what to do with this newly conquered territory. You know, should they trade it for peace? Could they trade it for peace? Well, let's hang on to it for a while and wait and see. It was always temporary, meant to be temporary. It's only over the last, you know, really since Netanyahu became prime minister, that people, that this idea of never giving up the West Bank has come to be part of the mainstream discourse. But this is really, really new. I mean, it's not something that was with people. If someone had told me 10 years ago that a prime minister of Israel or a member or the leader of a party in the coalition would publish an op-ed saying that he thought we should never give up the West Bank, I wouldn't have believed it.
Well, over 40 years later, though, it does seem a missed opportunity, and the situation just gets worse and worse. And I always wonder, just in closing, Elisa Goldman, is why mm-hmm. nobody seems to call Netanyahu and the Israeli right out and basically say, okay, guys, what is your end game? Just tell us your end game with the Palestinians.
That's a great question. What's the end game here? What do you want? Like, what do you foresee? No, they don't seem to have any end game in mind. There is no medium. This is a very big problem in Israel. you know, that that there's a tendency to avoid even medium-term planning. It's always about just leaping, grabbing branches and swinging from one crisis to the next. This is the way the country is run.
Well, Lisa Goldman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure as usual.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Goldman, who is the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation. She has lived and worked for over a decade in the Middle East, covering Israel-Palestine and the immediate region, including the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict and the 2011 Egyptian uprising. She is a co-founder and contributing editor to 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine that is based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into how much the drop in oil prices is impacting Russia and President Putin's rule.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Sullivan, who's a professor of economics at the National Defense University and a professor of security studies at Georgetown, as well as a senior fellow in future global resource threats at the Federation of American Scientists and a columnist for Türkiye Gazetesi in Istanbul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Sullivan.
Yes, good evening.
And the Russian government, through its development ministry, has revised its GDP forecast for 2015 from growth of 1.2% to a drop of 0.8%. So clearly Russia is feeling the pinch from the drop in oil prices as well as sanctions. Do you think the message is getting to Vladimir Putin?
Well, about 70% of Russia's exports are hydrocarbons. It's oil and gas. And when the oil price gets hit like this, then the GDP is going to be getting hit. Also, oil is a big part of the non-export part of the GDP of Russia. Is Putin getting the signal from the sanctions? I think he considers the sanctions a challenge. But I have a feeling the people of Russia are getting the point. With a decline in the ruble, their assets, their savings are evaporating, much like what happened in 1998 with the ruble crisis then. And jobs will be more scarce. There's a good chance there's going to be inflation. Russia's a mess right now. It is not really a brick. We really shouldn't call them bricks. We should call them BICs, without the R. Russia never belonged in that category.
And the BRICS are Brazil, Russia, India,
and China,
and South Africa, right? So, but surely, though, Putin can use sanctions as an excuse for his economic theft and mismanagement, just as Fidel Castro has used sanctions to hold on to power for decades.
Well, yes, he controls the information. He is a rather brutish leader, and he intimidates people. There's not a whole lot of pushback, and when there is, he reacts accordingly. There is a significant kleptocracy, if not mafiocracy, in Russia. If Russia really is to develop, they have to open up a free market, have a rule of law, and reduce the corruption that is at so many levels in the country. And I'm sure most Russians understand this is the case. But when information is pretty much controlled, not fully anymore, but controlled to a great deal, it's much more difficult to get the real story out.
Well, but how do you get the real story out when the unreal or the fantasy story has captured the Russian people's imagination now? Putin has created this entire fantasy about what's happening in the world, and the people believe it. There is a national sense of humiliation, which he's tapping into, and he's at 80% popularity. So there doesn't seem to be any daylight between Putin and the Russian people.
Well, the Russian people have been through a lot. When the Soviet Union collapsed, so also did their economy, and the economies of all of Central Asian states, Mongolia, and others connected with the former Soviet Union. There is also a sense that Russia is no longer what it was, or at least what it pretended to be at one time. A lot of Russians believe that it was a great power during the last few years of the Soviet Union, but what it was a fourth world country with nuclear weapons. Its economic presentation was also unreal back then through something called the Gosplan. Numbers for prices and output and all that were so phony, they were just picked out of the air. Right now, you can build a narrative. He can build a narrative that the West is trying to go after them. But let's do remember, he invaded, not the West.
Well, but that's a kind of pointless argument, isn't it, when you're dealing with this kind of unreality? The question surely is, how do we navigate around the fact that there is this information hold on the Russian people? And how do you, you know, because I think one of the problems with discussing this issue is a lot of critics of the West, in the West, blame NATO expansion eastward for Russia's problems and even justifying their invasions. But on the other hand, the other reality is that Putin is stealing the country blind, him and the Siloviki around him, his intelligence cronies. So that, but those two narratives aren't mutually exclusive. On the one hand, Putin is the biggest kleptocrat on the planet, and two, NATO expansion eastward hasn't been helpful.
Well, it was NATO expansion eastward was a challenge to Russia and to Putin. And Putin is a fifth dan in judo. He's a battler. He's a street kid from St. Petersburg who grew up since a child wanting to be a KGB agent, and he was a street fighter. So when he's challenged, he's going to react in that way, even though the Savliki and he may be more sophisticated than in their street gang youth. The instincts are still there. But the West may have to figure out a new policy here unless we really want to walk into a maelstrom. You certainly have heard about the ships that went through the English Channel, the large aircraft going across the East Coast and the long bomber runs coming out of Russia recently. This isn't just a training exercise. There's something building out there, and it's starting to feel somewhat uncomfortable.
So what you're telling us now, Paul, is really at the heart of what I think is a very, very, you know, difficult period we're going through. And it would seem to me that, you know, just these overflights, buzzing NATO facilities, sending submarines into Swedish waters, etc., it's as though Putin is trying to provoke an incident to basically, again, to tell his people that everything he's doing is right in taking on the West, and the West is out to get them, which they already believe. And this, he's just fishing for evidence, or fishing for a confrontation. So what do we do? I mean, with John McCain coming in as chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, if we start arming Ukraine, which is he wants to do, won't we be taking Putin's bait?
Well, in a way that could be. It depends on how it's done. And when it comes to the overflights and the submarines and all of that, this could also be Putin trying to figure out what the West's reaction might be, not necessarily to provoke a dangerous reaction. This may be more reconnaissance and intelligence collection. He wants to see what's out there to challenge him if anything does happen. But it's also to show that within his own country, he's still the tough guy. Remember, this is the guy who likes to go wrestling with bears and driving in the snow shirtless or whatever else he's doing to show that he's still in charge. Yes, he does have a lot of credibility, and many people in Russia do believe that he turned the country around, even though what really turned the country around was the change in the oil prices soon after he took over. It is very dangerous. It is potentially more dangerous than a lot of people are thinking right now. Arming the Ukrainians in the West, it depends on how we do that, how we present that, what is the narrative on our side. And then there's the question of whether we can afford this, and not just the United States, but NATO in general. The defense budgets of the other NATO states are tiny in comparison to ours. If anyone is going to be relied upon, if anything happens, it will be the United States more than anyone else.
Well, but again, you get to the problem of how do you shape perceptions and reality in Russia itself and somehow get around Putin? Because if you take the bait and literally fall into his narrative, you know, you're not going to make... I mean, in other words, how do you get the Russian people to wake up to the fact that Putin and his cronies, the Siloviki, are stealing the country blind? They're manipulating the Russian people without ginning up outside threats. Putin, I think, in many ways, maybe is delusional. At least the German leader, Angela Merkel, even suggested he might be losing his mind. He obviously took on too much. Crimea is a mess. Ukraine is a mess. Whatever part of Ukraine he ends up with is going to be a massive economic burden. It seems to me that he's doing everything he can to avoid his own mistakes and the consequences of his own mistakes.
Well, one thing that we've all seen, and I have certainly seen this, the longer a leader is in charge, the more likely it is they will become delusional. And we can think of many of those. And the fact that he's delusional and not, I'm not certain right now, but some of his behavior is. But he is also very, very clever, and he understands his own people. How to change the narrative in Russia is very difficult. It's like trying to change the narrative in any other country. It really has to change from within, which is a very difficult thing to do. It could be a carrot and stick approach. You could do the McCain tactics, but at the same time do some outreach, but that may be seen as contradictory and weak in Russian eyes. We have sanctions on. The sanctions are tightening up. The Europeans are having difficulty with those sanctions. So if we show weakness in our attempt to change the narrative, then that may backfire on us. This is definitely a wicked problem, as strategic people would call it. Again, this is going to take a long time. Who is the alternative to Putin? We could be looking at something else. And one thing I picked up on the other day was that Putin and others are thinking that the sanctions have to do with regime change in Russia. I think if anyone's thinking along that way, that's complete madness. Because a regime change in such a complicated and potentially unstable country, particularly with the oil prices going down and other things that are happening, could bring chaos to the borders of Europe.
And you could end up with somebody worse than Putin, right?
You could definitely end up with someone worse than Putin. There are a lot of those in the line of the Siloviki just waiting to walk right in. And this is not what we need. It's sort of you have the devil you know, at least you can talk with him. But if he becomes more delusional and more dangerous, and that has not been historically improbable in Russia if we look at previous leaders, this is a complicated problem that if we had strategic leaders in Washington, we could figure out what to do. But right now, it is a mixed bag in Congress, and the White House is playing very careful with this. And the Europeans are not unified. China is in many ways supporting Russia with the gas deals and military exercises, increased trade and others. The Indians are turning toward Russia. The Japanese are ambivalent. Again, we don't have a lot of allies left in the world. And Russia's a big country. It's not necessarily the most powerful economy, but it has a significant military. And also has significant other powers that can cause a lot of mischief in the world. And we have to be extremely careful with what happens next.
So when you hear now that the cancellation of the South Stream gas pipeline from Russia to Europe is being touted as a victory for Europe and the EU over Russia, and that now Putin has turned to Turkey, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't think we should be howling into the wind on this. I think this was a financial decision on the part of the Russians, and frankly, I think it's temporary. They've been hit pretty hard by the drop in oil prices, much more than by the sanctions. And I think this is a basic financial decision. Claiming victory on this feeds into his narrative. If many of our leaders simply say this is a financial decision, they can't afford it, even though they've invested a lot and they're looking for alternatives like a pipeline down to Turkey, well, that's fine. But if we're jumping up and down like we won the football game, this isn't even the first down. The South Stream was an issue with us. It has been for a very long time as a competitor to the Nabucco pipeline and other pipelines which we preferred. But given the sensitivity of the moment, we should really present a different viewpoint on this, no matter what the end result might be or who pumps gas to whom.
Well, just in closing, Paul Sullivan, when you mentioned dancing in the end zone, triumphalism, isn't that one of the problems, that we missed the boat, that we claimed we won the Cold War and there was too much dancing in the end zone and there wasn't enough attention paid to that moment when Russia could have made a transformation into a more liberal democracy, and we simply were absent?
We were not necessarily absent, but a lot of our so-called expert economists were talking about shock therapy that didn't exactly work. And there wasn't a lot of outreach to understand what was happening with the Russian people. In Moscow and in some of the major cities, you may get a sense that it's a modern state. Travel 50 miles outside and you're back in the 1950s. If we are going to have creative, productive, and peaceful relations with the Russians in the future, we have to have a lot more people understanding who they are. And the real Russia experts, they're retiring. It doesn't seem there are a lot of them coming around the bend, not a whole lot of younger people studying Russia. They mostly focused on the Middle East, on Iraq, on Iran, because those were the wars we were in Afghanistan. We need more Russia experts. We need people who understand them, and we need to understand to be careful with them, to understand what's going on, to protect our interests by being smart, not dancing in the end zone.
Well, Paul Sullivan, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Sullivan, who's a professor of economics at the National Defense University and a professor of security studies at Georgetown University, as well as a senior fellow in future global resource threats at the Federation of American Scientists and a columnist for Turkiye Gazetesi in Istanbul. He studies the political economy of oil and gas, the economics of war and peace, and energy security and Russia-Ukraine-EU energy issues. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into yet another failure to indict a white police officer in the killing of a black man. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And Brian, as a former NYPD police officer, what is your response to the grand jury that refused to indict the officer responsible for Eric Garner's death? And we all, of course, have seen that videotape of Eric Garner, who apparently was selling cigarettes on the street, who was wrestled to the ground by an NYPD police officer with a chokehold. He kept crying out, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." And as a result of him being subdued by this particular police officer and a number of others, he died on the spot. So it's one of those things where just after Ferguson, you just wonder how much more the African-American community can take in terms of their almost eroding or evaporating sense of justice in this country.
And I think you made an excellent point, and that is we have these particular cases, and in order to actually have a conviction after trial, it's not the evidence that we had here before a grand jury, which is lower, it really takes a fair amount of evidence. That being said, these cases are deeply emotionally charged and troubling, irrespective of what the legal outcome is. For instance, as we've seen, a ProPublica study showed that African Americans between 15 and 19 are 21 times more likely to die in interactions with law enforcement. So we have a lot of work to do here. This is another tragedy. First is, when I was on the job, this is 1985, chokeholds were prohibited, and they've been prohibited ever since. So what I think we have to look at is, let's take these officers at their word. What can we still do to minimize these kinds of tragic deaths? And let's look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the police. There's still something going wrong that we need to improve. I'm trying to look at this holistically. So I think several things. First is, New York City, unlike Ferguson, actually has a very significant representation of people of color. They've done a tremendous job. I've done research on this over the last two decades, of going from a predominantly white department to a department that is very diverse. That's something the departments have to do. I also think there has to be something looked at in not escalating incidents. How can police actually use their primary duties as service-oriented folks as opposed to enforcement folks, and not taking, for instance, cigarette sales or minor altercations and escalating them? And I think there are a couple of things. One, we have to look at technology. And I know that's not the answer many people want to hear, but we have to look at technology in addition to community policing. And one of the things we have to review is, how do we deal with people who are not the most compliant when it comes to arrests? And I think what this has shown in great detail is exactly why chokeholds are prohibited by the New York City Police Department and departments around the country, because it cuts off the oxygen to the brain. While it may make someone compliant, there is too much of a risk of killing people. So what can we do with respect to training and other non-lethal technologies that we can enable law enforcement to have, so that in 2 or 3 years from now, this will be looked at as an era of really antiquated technology? So community policing, having a police department that's representative of the community, having training both in how not to escalate situations and how to deal with people who may not be fully compliant without taking their life.
Well, it's not entirely clear how not fully compliant the victim was in this case, Brian Levin. I mean, obviously, the thing that troubles a lot of people is the proportionality of the so-called crime versus the fact that the victim ends up dead at the hands of the police. In the case of Ferguson, the 18-year-old African-American boy stole a couple of cigars and ended up dead. In this case, this guy was selling some cigarettes on the street. Apparently, he'd been doing it on and off for a long time, and he was a well-known fixture. You just wonder about why police resources in this case are being spent on something that doesn't sound like, certainly not, a capital offense.
Oh, Absolutely. And when I said not fully compliant, what I said is looking at this case in the light most favorable to the police, what can we still do? So that was my point, not to put any one victim or the police on trial. But I think you make an excellent point, and that's something that I think New Yorkers are going to look at, and that is how should police respond during a time when crime rates are historically low? And I think some police practices can actually escalate things and separate folks from the community. There's a lot of discretion involved in policing. I was a police officer. I almost used deadly force, so I realize what it's like from a police officer's point of view. That being said, I think we have to look into, do we want to make interactions with the police more confrontational or more community and service oriented? That's not to say that we should let serious crimes go, but I think you made a significant point that we don't want to get into situations where we have so many minor instances where some of them will be escalated to a point where someone's life will be taken. I think that's an excellent point and part of the overall set of issues that we have to look at with regard to training and enforcement. We don't want to enforce to such an extent that we are alienating the community that we want to serve. We don't want to give everyone a ticket for going 66.
This, of course, is a breaking story, Brian. People are taking to the streets in New York, as they did in Ferguson, Missouri. You can almost expect that kind of outcome because the outrage is palpable in the African-American community, as well as in lots of communities around the country. It's not entirely a black and white issue here, because a number of people of other ethnicities have also been victims of police brutality. But in this case, you get the feeling that compounding what just happened in Ferguson, there's a pattern here of taking these cases to a grand jury in order to avoid a trial and to make sure that you come out with the kind of outcomes that we've had both in Ferguson and in Staten Island.
Well, you know, In New York City, like here in California, California has a law and a state Supreme Court ruling which says that all evidence that could be exculpatory, that is, helping the defendant, must be introduced before a grand jury. New York City prosecutors do that as a matter of course as well. And we've seen this before, for instance, in the Bernard Goetz subway shooting case in the 1980s, the first grand jury refused to indict. And again, New York City is an area where all kinds of evidence, including evidence that's helpful to the defendant, is introduced as a matter of course. In police cases that involve an issue of possible arrest or self-defense, unlike the Louima case, which is prosecuted federally, where someone was sodomized and basically tortured, this involved kind of these street interactions where there was some kind of conflict and arrest is taking place. When the evidence is conflicted, juries, not only by law, will go with the defendant, but they generally tend to side with police when there's issues of trying to effect an arrest or self-defense. And maybe we need to look at having a different type of grand jury system that responds specifically to police-involved cases. I think there's going to be a whole public national dialogue on what to do in cases like this. And let me just step back, though. There are more broad issues about trust with communities. Luckily, the NYPD has an excellent commissioner who was very good with civil rights. When he was in Boston, he helped with the first hate crime unit. He's been known to be sensitive to this kind of stuff. The problem is, do we want enforcement to a level where we will have so many potentially conflictual interactions that some will escalate? And that's an issue. Secondly, we need to enhance techniques that can get someone in custody without killing them, particularly nonviolent, unarmed people, even people who might be quite sizable. And that's an important thing, too. And more broadly, though, you know, you can't just magically introduce trust with a community. It's got to be part of the elemental foundational principles of the department on a daily basis. So training, leadership, community outreach, and I think making decisions about what to enforce and what not to enforce. Because, again, there are certain things that, you know, the first thing a police officer learns is you can't arrest everybody for everything.
Well, Brian Levin, I would have thought in this case, the fact that the autopsy by New York City's medical examiner found that Mr. Garner's death was a homicide,
yes,
resulting from the chokehold by the police officer, would not that change the dynamics of a grand jury? I mean, it certainly did not. That was not the case in Ferguson, where the officer was charged by the medical examiner as having committed homicide, or at least the victim is dead because of homicide. Surely that changes the dynamics of a case, doesn't it?
It does and it doesn't. Let me tell you what I mean. It was definitely a homicide in that it was caused by the interaction of somebody else. The issue is, was there enough to show that it was either justifiable or unjustifiable? And even though, and this is what I think is interesting, his career is still in jeopardy because the chokehold is not allowed. I have the patrol guide, NYPD, up on my shelf. It is not allowed. However, just because somebody violates a rule of employment does not automatically make that murder or manslaughter. I think that there are a lot of people who think, in looking at the video and hearing his complaint, that would think that maybe that could have gone that way. But I think because it was one of those things where it happened in a relatively quick time frame, that the jury, and I'm not excusing it, I'm just saying this is what I think happened, said, you know, even though there were some things wrong, we're still not at the point of tipping the scale further. And when the evidence is in conflict, law requires that a grand jury not indict. Now, maybe there's something with respect to how the evidence is presented. There are all kinds of things. In other words, if you're playing a ball game and the referee calls things a certain way, you can still play by all the rules but not have the result that many people would think is fair.
So far, of course, there hasn't been in New York City itself the outrage expressed in Ferguson following the shooting of Michael Brown. In this case, there haven't been demonstrations, but they are starting now, I think, in response to the acquittal by the grand jury of not bringing charges against Officer Pantaleo, who used the chokehold, which you said was banned when you were a police officer.
Yes, in 1985. One of the first things they taught us in the academy, do not use a chokehold because of the risk of death by cutting off oxygen in the arteries to the brain.
So,
period.
So that's pretty instructive there in this case. At this point, you know, Bratton is trying to calm things down. So is Mayor de Blasio. But clearly, this is a bitter pill to swallow, particularly after Ferguson. Is there any chance then with the federal authorities picking up the ball here? I mean, that seems to be what people are using to try and calm down these anguished and angry people in New York City and around the country who really have had enough, particularly after Ferguson.
Well, a couple of things. For a federal prosecution to take place, they'd use the federal criminal civil rights law that was enacted shortly after the Civil War. It's now called Deprivation of Civil Rights Under Color of Law, 18 United States Code 242 for those who want to look it up. But what it requires is an intent to interfere with the victim's civil rights. And that's going to be really difficult to prove. Oftentimes, but not always, that's going to involve a racial motive. But what the officer can do to counter that is to say, you know, I was caught in a difficult situation with someone who was bigger than me, wasn't fully compliant. I'm just saying this is what he would say. And that's going to obviate a claim that there was some kind of intentional interference with civil rights generally based on race. Different from the Abner Louima case where this person was tortured rectally with a plunger. That's different. So here when there's an issue of an attempt to make a lawful arrest and there's some conflict, it's very difficult under federal law to prosecute it. It's even more difficult than it is at the state level. So that's unlikely. With respect to the Justice Department getting some kind of consent decree or taking the NYPD to court, that's going to be more difficult than Ferguson as well because, you know, the NYPD, when I was there, had an African-American commissioner. They really are at the cutting edge of many things with respect to community relations, And the chokehold is prohibited in their patrol guide, and we're not trained to do it. So in other words, it wouldn't be like the Justice Department could come in and say, stop training with the chokehold. We don't train that in the NYPD and haven't for at least 30 years, certainly when I came in January 85.
Well, that's what's so extraordinary to get your head around, though. A man is dead for selling cigarettes on the street. We all saw the videotape of him being brought to the ground by this police officer, and two others were helping. And he's crying out, you know, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And presumably they did not relent because he died of a chokehold. You just wonder, and it also comes up in the case of Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson. It is, you know, it seems to me that what happened there, that the officer, police officer just got mad as hell that this kid attacked him in his police car and just saw red and lost his bearings, and thus this tragedy. In this case, it does seem some, you know, what I didn't want a better expression than testosterone-driven, that there was an unnecessary adrenaline rush of violence there that seemed to be disproportionate both to the so-called crime of selling cigarettes and the need to subdue this man who was not being aggressive. I mean, it's all there on tape.
One of the difficult things that comes up, and I'm very sensitive to this, is that there are times when someone can turn in a second. I'm not saying that justifies anything like that, but we had a case with a guy named Stephen McDonald in the 1980s. There was a report of a stolen bicycle. He went up to a kid who you know, had a bicycle, and he was you know, almost an adorable kid, and the kid pulled a gun and shot him, and he was paralyzed for life. So police are constantly balancing, on the one hand, you know, what kind of force to use, because they never know if the next second something else might happen. Also, I think you made another point about getting caught up in the adrenaline rush. There was a time when a guy jumped out of a fire escape in the back of an apartment. I saw him run. I was the only one in the back of that apartment. He turned. I saw something that looked like metal. I thought he was reaching for a gun. I was a split second away from shooting him. It turned out to be leather mittens with a little metal clasp, and I had a split second. So we really have to look at these situations where there might be someone who is bigger than average. How do we, if they're not fully compliant, get them compliant without killing them? This is a really big deal with regard to training and technology. And the other thing is really opening up to police to let them know, you know, this is someone's father, this is someone's son, and not get caught into that. Because when you're in the middle of adrenaline, like when I was in that situation, I was a split second away from shooting someone who was not armed. And that's something I walk on my shoulders with every time I hear this kind of thing. Well, it's a terrible, terrible tragedy for the city, for this family, and we have to understand that there will be people who, in the course of police interactions that may not be fully cooperative. How do we maintain the situation without escalating it to the point where someone is killed? Certainly a chokehold is completely inappropriate by training and by policy of the NYPD.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis for hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as the associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was also a New York City police officer in Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.